Good evening, everyone. Here's the lecture hall and watching us live online. My name is Aichi Chibukchu. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Sociology. I'm the co-director of LSE Human Rights here at the London School of Economics. It is a pleasure to welcome you to the school and a great honor indeed to introduce our speaker tonight, Professor Samuele Zadra. Professor Mezadra is a political philosopher, maybe he prefers theorist, but I always think of him as a political philosopher who teaches in Italy at the University of Bologna. Broadly construed, his scholarship, as many of you here would know, has centered on the relation between globalization, migration, and capitalism, as well as postcolonial criticism. One of the greatest Marxist theorists of our time, as well as a public and organic intellectual, he is the author of numerous books, as well as political pamphlets. In Italian, his books include, and let me try to be an internationalist here and in the spirit of solidarity, please forgive my pronunciation and broken accent. I'll try. In Italian, his books are Diritto di Fuga, Migrazioni, Cittadinanza, and Globalizzazione, which was published in 2006. La Condizione Postcoloniale, sorry for butchering your language, Storia e Politica nel Presente Globale, which was published in 2008, Nei Cantieri Marxiani e Sovietiche e la sua Produzione, which was published in 2014, and there's an English translation, an English edition, titled In the Marxian Workshop, which was published in 2018, and also in Italian, Un mondo da guadagnare per una teoria politica del presente, which was published in 2020. Professor Mezadra has written in English and has been translated in English as well. His writings include the field-defining and groundbreaking book, Whomever Works on Migration Should Not Ignore This. It's called Border as Method or the Multiplication of Labor, which was published by Duke University Press in 2013, and which was co-authored with his longtime collaborator, Brett Nielsen, as well as his 2019 book, The Politics of Operations, Excavating Contemporary Capitalism, which was also published by Duke University Press. Today, I was delighted to have learned that Professor Mezadra has a new forthcoming book in English. Welcome everyone. The Rest and the West, which he has once again co-authored with Brett Nielsen and which will be published very soon, we hope.
Yes.
It's been sent to the press. And with Michael Hart of Duke University, Professor Mezadra has also written what he called a pamphlet focusing on questions of development in Bolivia, which will be out next month in English. So looking back, I realize we had known each other with Professor Mezadra for some 15 years. Since we first co-organized a conference on migration at Columbia University, I think it was 2009, and then another conference on migration in Bologna in 2010. It's a tremendous pleasure and a great honor for us to welcome him to the LSE today for our annual lecture on internationalism, cosmopolitanism, and the politics of solidarity, hosted by LSE Human Rights every year. As some of you would remember, our annual lecture last year was given by Professor Ruthie Wilson Gilmore of City University of New York, and the year before it was delivered by Professor Etienne Balibar. Professor Mezadra's lecture tonight is titled Spaces of Struggle, Rethinking Internationalism in an Age of War and Transition. It will last for about 50 minutes, I reckon. We will then hold a, what I hope will be an intense conversation with the audience for about an hour. So we're here together for 2 hours, the event will end at 8 p.m. Hold your questions, please. We'll get to each one, I hope. The lecture will be followed by a reception. So you have the chance to speak with Professor Mehta afterwards for the reception, for the lecture, for everything. I would like to thank Laura Wayne of the Department of Sociology for making everything possible, as well as the LSC events staff who are helping us tonight. If everybody is in the lecture hall, I would like to welcome Professor Sandro Mezzadra with much excitement and anticipation. Sandro?
So thank you so much, Aicha, for this general introduction. I wrote the paper for today's speech. This is not something I usually do, and I'm not very good at writing papers. It is not part of my training. You know, in Italy, you have to show up and improvise a bit of theater. I hope the paper will be at least, let's say, good. I'm very happy, really, to be here with you today and to have the occasion to share with you some ideas that I have been recently elaborating with my friend, comrade, and collaborator Brett Nilsson for this new book that we have just finished to write. And in this book, Rethinking Internationalism is the urgent and difficult task that we outline based on an analysis of the mutations of global capitalism in an age of pandemic and war. We try to think together pandemic and war. We are facing a disruption of the so-called rules-based international system that challenges established forms of liberal internationalism and corresponding cosmopolitan discourses. Such a disruption signals a deeper shift within the capitalist world system that we need to carefully investigate to test the potentialities of a different form of internationalism, one rooted in the long history of anarchist, socialist, and communist internationalism. We are living through a tumultuous transition at the global level, with momentous implications at local as well as national and regional scales. And the main question behind my engagement in rethinking of internationalism regards the possibility and conditions of a radical politics of struggles beyond the nation, capable to unfold within and against the transition we are living through, to occupy and, in a way, to hijack it. I'm aware, of course, that such question is not new. Since the 1990s, it has been at the center of many attempts to rethink cosmopolitanism, in particular. It has been at the center of many efforts to rethink cosmopolitanism from below, a kind of vernacular form of political practice. Antonio Gramsci's critique of cosmopolitanism as a form of abstract universalism is met in these efforts by a search for a kind of rooted universal that continues to be inspiring today, despite the need to critically investigate what Tarek Yazil calls the planetary geographical imaginations underlying the very notion of cosmopolitanism. The way in which the world is imagined and taken as a unity is indeed implicated with colonial and imperial legacy. And moreover, in the age of Anthropocene and Capitalocene, the planet that has emerged over the last two decades as a concept different from the ones of globe and world takes on features of vulnerability and even agency that need to be reflected in the very epistemology of international. So maybe we can come later again to the issue of cosmopolitanism, but closer to my own theoretical approach and political experiences, allow me now to mention as an antecedent of my engagement with internationalism, Michael Hart and Tony Negri's Empire that came out in the year 2000. What seems really interesting to me in that book is what Hart and Negri call the paradox of incommunicability, which means the fact that, I quote, in our much celebrated age of communication, struggles have become all but incommunicable. While this could be presented as a paradox in a conjuncture that appears to be characterized by powerful vectors of unification of the world market and the globe, it continues to haunt us facing the deep fractures, tensions, and conflicts crisscrossing global capitalism today. This does not mean, as I will show later, that cross-border processes of communication, circulation, and translation among struggles do not exist in the contemporary world. But these processes continue to encounter bottlenecks and a myriad of obstacles that must be considered if we are to rethink internationalism not only as a discourse, but also as a political force and a power act. But wait a second, internationalism. Actually, I do not know if this name remains valid today. And there are at least two reasons behind my hesitation. Firstly, the history of internationalism in the 20th century is characterized by memorable episodes of solidarity across countries and continents that may be instantiated by geographical names such as Spain and Vietnam. I could, of course, mention a panoply of other episodes. But nonetheless, it is also true that communist internationalism has served too often as an instrument to cover up for the national interests of the Soviet Union, with catastrophic implications in the age of Stalin, and the name of Spain is, of course, again redolent here. And such implications cast a shadow on the very name internationally. Secondly, and maybe more importantly, there is a need to stress that in the history of internationalism, it has been taken for granted that the unit of organization was provided by the nation. Consider that when Marx started to write about the topic in the 1840s, the process of nationalization of the state and of the political map was far from accomplished in Europe. Internationalism was an extraordinary political invention and anticipation, as no less than Jacques Derrida presses with respect to a movement that, I quote, presented itself as geopolitical, thereby inaugurating the space that is now ours and that today is reaching its limits, the limits of the earth and the limits of the political. We have reached those limits. And we may need another political invention foreshadowing a variable geometry of spaces for political action beyond the space, and an intertwining of those spaces through organizational and even institutional processes of networking. But what remains with us, independently of the name, is the problem addressed by international. Simply put, the forging of a political language capable to address heterogeneous conditions of domination and exploitation in different parts of the world while articulating a common desire for liberation. This is to me the problem behind the name international. The historical archives of internationalism remain sources of inspiration for us. Above all, regarding political experience, they test the limits of the nation as the privileged site for organizing. New research on the Third International and the so-called Global South, starting with the Baku Congress of the Peoples of the East in 1920, present a Comintern as the fulcrum of a multi-centered global history of 20th century anti-colonial insurgencies and revolts with the long-standing implications for present-day political organizing. A quote from the introduction by Paolo Capuzzo and Anna Garland-Mahler to a recent book on the Third International and Global South. Traditions of anti-colonial solidarity and pan-Africanism, for instance, the politicization of Black diasporas in response to the 1935 Italian invasion of Ethiopia, must be added here. Moreover, we must remain attentive to what I like to call resonances of struggles that crisscross the history of anti-imperialist movement. Think, for instance, of the slogan "Fiat is our Vietnam," popular in Italy in the early 1970s, or of the words employed by the North Vietnamese Minister of Culture to greet the delegation of the Black Panther Party, led by Bobby Seale, at the Hemispheric Conference to end the war in Vietnam, Montreal, 1968. You are Black Panthers. We are Yellow Panthers. I would be delighted to follow this line of historical excavation. But I must come to the challenges of our present, which may be hard to tackle, but build the crucial test for the rethinking of the problem of international. In doing so, I follow from the viewpoint of method, Lenin's passionate restlessness during the Great War, his attempt to come to terms with the historical novelty of imperialism to reframe basic aspects of communist politics in Russia and on the world scale. be clear, I do not think that Lenin's theory of imperialism is particularly helpful for us today. But this struggle to include, quote and unquote, geopolitical factors within his understanding of class struggle and politics in a conjunction of unprecedented war and large-scale massacres in Europe remains, I repeat, methodically inspired. How to make sense of the fracture and conflict of the international system today is a question that haunts many scholars, disciplines, and public debate. In the West, the prevailing answers center upon such catchphrases as the end of globalization with related reshoring, nearshoring, friendshoring, decoupling, and the like, or more directly, the new Cold War. Already circulating during the COVID-19 pandemic, such rhetoric has gained even more momentum in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. In our recent work, Brett Nielsen and I take a critical stance on this rhetoric, and we demonstrate that global processes continue to shape capitalism across diverse geographical scales, although their homogeneous characters translate onto heterogeneous formations when they hit the ground, as we like to say, due to the encounter with a panoply of dynamics of political, legal, and territorial variegation. Brett and I follow Giovanni Arrighi and other world system scholars in their diagnosis of the crisis of the US global hegemony. But we remain wary of any prospect of a straightforward hegemonic transition, say, to China as the new hegemon. And this is because our analysis of contemporary capitalism points to a set of processes and logics, to a rationality driving processes of valorization and accumulation that exist in tension with what Arrighi calls territorialism. This is not something new, but we contend that today such tensions and gaps are intensified to the point Africa. This hypothesis provides us with a crucial point of entry into the analysis of multipolarity, a concept that we use to describe the current global predicament, remaining aware of its controversial nature. And this means that we do not only take a radical distance from the usage of multipolarity by the Putin regime and its ideologues, like, for instance, Alexander Dugin's civilizational inflection of the concept, but also from the variations on the language of polarity in international relations, where states, nations, great powers are usually considered the exclusive actors in world politics. And to the contrary, we stress the role played in the very constitution of multipolarity today by capitalist actors and operations, while we carefully investigate the operative spaces, as we call them, they create, for instance, in the fields of logistics, in the field of energy distribution, infrastructures, digitalization, and finance. Such operative spaces intersect and even intermingle with the territorial boundaries circumscribing states and nations, but they can never be reduced to them or to the emerging poles of the contemporary world. This is why we agree with Adam Tooze when he speaks of a centrifugal multipolarity. Centrifugal not simply because of the lack of a corresponding order, but also, as we had, because operations of capital structurally decenter the process of polar formation. And we understand such process of polar formation as open and far from being accomplished. We also emphasize that while far from being exclusive, territorial logics crisscross the constitution of Poland. If you take Russia, it is clear that in Putin's vision of a gross realm for the Russian world and economy, territorial concerns and an imperialist design of expansion are clearly prevailing. But the territorial reduction of the complexity of processes of fall formation is possible also beyond the Russian instance. And it can lead to a simplification of the international tension within a logic of confrontation and war. Apart from being an accurate description of the current state of relations between the US and China, the rhetoric of the new Cold War can work as a weapon in this direction, with willing actors ready to embrace it both in Washington and in Beijing. So it is against this background that the Ukraine war should be critically analyzed, stressing the related proliferation of what we call war regimes in many parts of the world, including Europe and East Asia. The struggle against the Ukraine war, the struggle to stop the violence, terror, and devastation that civilian populations have endured since Russia's invasion, builds therefore a struggle to stop the prospect of future inter-imperialist wars. Imperialism today needs to be analyzed from the angle of the unstable balance between territorialism and capital, which does not mean to blame it on the former, on territorialism, as a kind of atavistic logic, to echo Joseph Schumpeter. What really matters for an understanding of contemporary forms of imperialism are rather the convergences and alliances between territorial powers and capitalist actors that take the simplification of international tensions as an occasion for huge profits and may even push toward such simplification. It remains true today that there is no imperialism that is not capitalist imperialism, and that there is no internationalism that is not anti-imperialist and against the war, as well as the proliferation of war regimes. So the first task we face in such conditions is to complexify even more our understanding of processes of pole formation. I stressed two layers of such processes, a territorial layer and a capitalist layer. Now I need to add another layer, a layer that brings me closer to the topic of internationalism. What I have in mind is the constitutive role of social movements and class struggle writ large in the international realm. As the common sense goes, there is no class struggle in the international realm. Brett Nilsson and I challenge this common sense And we make the case for an analysis of the processes of pole formation that emphasizes the roles played by struggles and social dynamics. This is for us a methodologically crucial point that allows shedding light on the contradictions and even antagonism that shape the social dimension of pole formation. In doing so, we are, of course, inspired by recent transnational campaigns, by the movements that in the late 1990s emerged as a powerful counterpart to capitalist globalization between Seattle, Porto Alegre, and Genoa, as well as by processes of circulation of struggles across borders, for instance, in the Occupy cycle in 2011. 13 in the case of the movement for Black Lives in the US in 2020, and also of the Iranian uprising of 2022-23 under the slogan Woman, Life, and Freedom, a Kurdish slogan, as you may know. But this is only part of the story. This we also focus on more elusive forms of struggle, as for instance, the ones crisscrossing the spaces produced by movements of migration, which play pivotal roles in processes of class formation in many parts of the world. So it is within this emerging and contested multipolarity, and keeping into account the tensions and conflicts that are constitutive of processes of world formation, that the problem and prospects of internationalism must be reframed. There is no shortage of research and theoretical work that may help us in the exploration of what we may call these uncharted lands and seas, to echo Machiavelli's discourse. I'm thinking, for instance, of the notion of critical regionalism elaborated by Gayatri Spivak, with an emphasis on the plural dimensions of the region, or of a book published by Kwangsin Chen in 2010, Asia as Method, where Asia, quote and unquote, appears as a kaleidoscope of regional spaces traversed by the presence of other continental actors, above all, of course, the US. We are confronted here with at least two features that remain valid to grasp the peculiarity of the emerging spaces of multipolarity. Thinking together, Spivak and Kwangsin Chen, we see firstly that the emerging spaces of multipolarity do not share the imagined territorial homogeneity of modern nation states. They are rather profoundly uneven, heterogeneous, and even fragmented. Secondly, the emerging spaces of multipolarity are not bounded spaces, but rather crisscrossed by global vectors, and therefore open to multiple entwinements with other geographical formations. And these two aspects have important implications for any effort to rethink the problem of internationalism today. So let me provide the first general framework in this respect. Emerging regional spaces, emerging poles, do not foreshadow a fixed geography, which means that while they build the primary reference for the establishment of channels of communication between struggles, the resulting coordinates of political action can be easily multiplied and articulated with each other. Moreover, the deep heterogeneity of such spaces compels to take the problem of translation between different experiences, planes, and languages as a constitutive moment of organizing, which becomes even more important to enable an opening toward other global spaces. This is just a sketch of the politics of struggle within and against the processes of power formation and the emerging multipolar world of capital. I do not think we may provide or even need a model for such a policy. But nonetheless, let me quickly turn to the Latin American experiences of the last couple of decades. Although limited and contradictory, those experiences demonstrate at least the potentiality of a regional scale of struggle and political experimentation. So if one thinks of the 1980s and 1990s, when military dictatorships in many countries gave way to a process of quote and unquote transition to democracy, well, the region seemed completely caught in the Washington consensus, which means continued dependency on the US and further experimentation with a neoliberal policy inaugurated amid terror and blood by the Pinochet regime after the 1973 coup in Chile. But the situation changed quite dramatically toward the end of the 20th century, when a concatenation of uprisings at the regional scale from Ecuador to Bolivia to Argentina was followed by a proliferation of movements and struggles of a new type in most Latin American countries. Moreover, since 1994, the Zapatista rebellion in Mexico has played a fundamental role within this process, providing movements with a new language that circulated across and beyond the region and underscoring the leading role of indigenous movements in the new cycles of struggles. These uprisings and movements opened up, created a new regional space, within which, in the first long decade of the 21st century, new progressive governments were established, and new integration processes were launched along the axis established by President Lula of Brazil and President Chavez of Venezuela. This is not the place, of course, to make an assessment of such governments whose accomplishments in the fields of social policies against poverty and in some cases in dealing with indigenous claims and colonization were met by an intensification of extractive projects and by a myriad of compromises with established powers and corporate actors. What matters most for me now is that Latin America continues to be swept and traversed by dynamics of uprising and struggle that circulate across the region. Just think of the last few years. We have been witnessing a continuity of movements of uprising across Latin America, moving from country to country. The big revolt in Chile in October 2019 that remains a threshold in that country's political history despite the defeat of the new project of constitution at the referendum of September 2022 was soon followed by popular revolts in Ecuador with huge indigenous participation and by mass resistance against the coup in Bolivia. In May 2021, a mass unprecedented social movement against a fiscal reform in Colombia gave way to a general mobilization against the prevailing social and political system that created the conditions for wider change and for the electoral victory of President Gustavo Petro. To this, we should add that in December 2022, the destitution of President Castillo of Peru was countered by a widespread movement of insurgency led by peasants and indigenous people and violently repressed by security forces. There would be much more to say, of course, about Latin America, about the nested geography of what we can call an incipient process of cold formation, characterized by several regional organizations, by a multiplication of operative and infrastructural spaces of capital, and importantly, by the presence of both the US and China in the region. I should also talk about the new wave of so-called pink governments, including the international activism of, again, President Lula of Brazil. We can hark back to these important topics in the discussion if you wish. But for now, I want to dwell a bit more on a single, although very important movement, which means on the feminist mobilizations since 2015 in Argentina under the heading Mil Menos, not one left. What is striking here, what interests me now in this movement are the accelerated pace and the transformative power of the circulation of that movement at the regional scale, which led to the emergence of a Latin American dimension of feminist action that has swept many different countries to a politics of translation of organizational tools and political discourse, all to quite heterogeneous material. Importantly, the new Latin American feminism has produced powerful resonances both in the US and in Southern Europe, in countries like Italy and Spain. So what Veronica Gago calls the new feminist international is built upon a dense web of bodies in struggle, territorial and subjective specificities, situated practices of anti-colonial and anti-racist politics that defy the limits of nation state geometry without ever becoming abstract. Allow me to repeat, I hope I will not be misunderstood in this respect. I'm not presenting the Latin American experience as a model. True, the experience of Newna Menos has helped me to outline the rough framework I proposed before, centered on processes of organization within the regional space of approach and on what Brett Nilsson and I call continental intimacies, playing with the title of a remarkable book by Lisa Lowe. But this is just a rough framework that needs to be tested and modified in other contexts that are no less specific and internally variegated than the Latin American one. Nonetheless, there is something in the singular experience of recent Latin American feminist movements that may be helpful to tackle the vexed question in recent discussions of the problem of international. In a way, we can say that Gramsci's critique of cosmopolitanism that I mentioned before has kind of struck back with a vengeance on internationalism. That was for him, in a way, the other of cosmopolitanism, precisely due to the concrete mediation of the nation. Today, internationalism itself appears to many activists and scholars as abstract, reduced to an unending and eventually unproductive labor networking, remote from the concrete and everyday states of local grounded struggle. The challenge here is to understand in a different way the global space, to carve out translocal potentialities even from the most localized struggles, to combine the rootedness of political action with attention to the circulation and resonances across borders of those very struggles. traditional processes of networking may continue to be important, but maybe even more crucial is the multiplication of media projects within variable geometries of regional relations, of platforms and infrastructures that enable that circulation and those resonances, of subversive endeavors to facilitate the passage of illegalized people and the like. I think that only such projects and platforms can build the infrastructural skeleton of the new international to come, whatever its name. To conclude, allow me to act back to the way in which I framed the problem of internationalism at the very beginning of this talk. I spoke, you may remember, of the need to forge a political language capable to address heterogeneous conditions of domination and exploitation in different parts of the world, while articulating a common desire for liberation. It's a kind of problematic definition of the question of internationalism. And I am aware that my formulation raises a panoply of theoretical and political questions. Is it possible to address to a common language the heterogeneity of domination and exploitation? And maybe even more radically, does a common desire for liberation, my word, exist at all? Maybe it is easier to start with this latter question, since it is clear to me that such a desire does not exist as such, that we are rather confronted in many parts of the world with struggles, efforts, and movements that arise from a clash with specific systems of domination and exploitation, open cracks in their structure, but do not necessarily foreshadow a systematic search for liberation. This should be precisely the task of a new international, that whatever its name should work toward the reconstruction of a horizon of life beyond the rule of capital, and to demonstrate in a compelling way that such life is possible and desirable could figure prominently in our agenda in the tumultuous transition we are living through, haunted by war, persistent poverty, and specters of climate disruption. It will not be a manifesto written by armchair philosophers, of course, and it will not be a one-fits-all blueprint. When I say that we need to forge a new political language, I'm rather thinking of a collective endeavor rooted in different parts of the world, nurtured by heterogeneous experiences and struggles, and aiming at sketching a set of general principles and concepts to be translated in peculiar ways onto different material and geographical problems. But what about the heterogeneity of conditions of domination and exploitation we face today? Is it possible to forge a common language to target this heterogeneity? This is a question, as you all know, that haunts debates on intersectionality, where, for instance, Patricia Hill Collins proposes to distinguish between oppression and exploitation, to come to terms precisely with the heterogeneity of conditions of domination and exploitation. But we can add to these debates the quite different work of David Harvey and Nancy Fraser on the distinctiveness of disportation or exploitation, once again distinguished from exploitation. More generally, identity politics often takes today specific forms of oppression as a point of departure, but it ends up foreclosing or at least undermining the very possibility of coalitional effort. I have not the time today to address these burning issues. Let me just say that my own approach to this question is modestly predicated upon a systematic engagement with the question of difference, which emerges from the debates I cursorily mentioned, and on an attempt to radically rethink the notion of exploitation that is too often sidelined or understood in very and taking inspiration from the great image of the house of difference employed by Audre Lorde in Zami, I also attempt to reinvent the notion of the multitude to grasp the subjective states of a politics of liberation today. But to really conclude, I want to come back to the problem of international. And to the task to forge what I call a common political language capable to resonate in an effective way across regional and continental spaces. It is easy to see that what looms behind such formulation is the vexed question of the universal and universal. There is no need, I think, to discuss once again here the complicity of European universalism with colonialism, racism, and sexism. This is something I take for granted. Nonetheless, I follow this topic, the lead of Etienne Balibar, when he invites us to understand the universalism not as a set of given principles, but as a terrain of struggle. And Balibar emphasizes that any enunciation of the universal is not a factor of unification of human beings, but rather, as he has it, an element of conflict between and with themselves. You may have noticed that I employed several times the verb translate in this talk, and not by accident. Translation is not a catchword good for flyers or for political manifesto, but it nicely captures the theoretical and political states of rethinking of international. This is a question Brett Nilsson and I addressed in Borges' Method, mainly drawing inspiration from the remarkable work of Naoki Sakai. Once you do not understand the translation in merely linguistic terms, and you also raise the Gramscian question of the translatability of concepts and theoretical frameworks against the background of radically heterogeneous material and geographical context, universalism as a terrain of struggle begins to take concrete dimensions and to become that. Needless to say, far from being the solution, such a politics of translation builds an engaging task that must renounce the pitfalls of the search for complete transparency and take seriously the encounter with the untranslatability. I think there is something to learn here for our attempt to rethink international. And nonetheless, Translation in these terms is a task and should take up with respect both to the critique of heterogeneous conditions of domination and exploitation and to the political establishment of a common desire for liberation, to the forging of a new vision of what Gary Wilder calls in a recent book, the world we wish to see. And to pay tribute to a visionary whose words continue to echo in the present, allow me to add that this word will be once again a word to win. Thank you very much.
Which it's difficult to know where to begin. I do wonder if somebody has a burning question before I try to formulate an opening question for Professor Navarro. We do have a mic circulating, not we have to. Would you like to join or would you like to? This will last for about an hour. So, okay. You invited us for the conclusion of your lecture, Sandra, to not take translation literally, but to think of it in the context of this new language you are calling for, a new language of internationalism, where even the concept of internationalism is up for rethinking and reinvention, perhaps. So I want to begin with the question of language and your call for a new language in conjunction with the politics of translation. What are the difficulties of such a translation across different political regions, different political traditions, even different visions of the world we wish to see? Because it seems to me, on the one hand, okay, no, I will leave it there. And you can go back and forth. So this politics of language and translation, what are the difficulties?
Well, there are apparently many difficulties. Let me say that on one hand, when I started to think about the translation, let's say, as a political concept, I involved it to communication. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, translation emerged in my own experience as a political task in a very pragmatic way. You know, organizing assemblies with migrants of different nationalities. And translation was the condition for the conversations we had in those assemblies. There is, of course, a link between the two aspects that I just mentioned, because participating in those assemblies, I had face the fact that communication was not something given. Mm-hmm. That there was a linguistic problem, but that behind that linguistic problem, there was also, a panoply of different ways to see the world. So communication was really not the point. What was needed was a kind of a supplementary effort to create the condition of an encounter. Of an encounter that always remained in a way healthy. And from this point of view, I speak of the question of untranslatability. Mm-hmm. But those encounters were immensely productive, and not only for me, of course. Those encounters were the occasions for the coding of the new name. I don't want to generalize this experience, and I could be ranked about, let's say, the theoretical aspect of the question of translation. But I really think that in order to tackle the question of universalism that lies behind internationalism, translation provides us with some important and effective tools.
Yes, which immediately makes me wonder what exactly is untranslatable? What is the untranslatable? Are you saying there's some type of incommensurability that exists prior to the act of political translation? Of course, we're talking about translation between different contexts, different traditions. I'm asking this in the context of the tension you
yeah,
are.
That's a very important question. But in a way, the encounter with the untranslatability is what creates the condition. And taking seriously the issue of untranslatability, in a way, works as an antidote against the totalizing tendencies of universalism, but also of internationalism. Mm-hmm.
Get into this conversation, but I wonder if there are any questions. Yes, I see. I saw you first. Please.
I'm not even sure I know exactly how to frame this, but I'm interested in, you talked about migration, and I wonder how much global migration do you think the level of migration that we have helps or hinders liberation movements, and how much?
Okay, maybe I'll take one more question.
Yes, please.
Yes.
Maybe on this translation linguistic thing, I'm kind of interested in how you see how that kind of politics works when I feel like we exist, like the hegemonic powers are very good at co-opting like kind of new language, new terminology, or like in a way translating it into these different kind of de-radicalized ways. Like I'm thinking about a lot of Kurdish activists talking about Xinjiang Zadi and the way that has been really removed from its kind of context within like the Kurdish freedom movement, and now you see like much more liberal actors using that kind of rhetoric, but not necessarily with that same ideology, let's say. So like this process of co-optation and translation, how that works.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ben. And then let's have a round of answers and then I'll take more questions. Do you need a microphone? Perhaps for the online audience, it might be helpful.
I'm really interested in this phrase you used about the kind of presumption of liberation.
Mm-hmm.
And how we put that adjacent to a majority world that even in the continental exchanges of Latin America, Latin Africa, and Asia. There's a majority population that are not even speaking, turning to the vocabularies of capitalism, sovereignty, and nationalism. They're finding kind of everyday compositions of distribution, of coping, of endurance. And I wonder, in relation to the kind of political economies that you're studying, how you would have a conversation side by side with the kinds of scholars like Fred Moten, Abdulmanik Simone, that are talking about a mode of distribution that is outside of these established categories, that in many ways are the things that we have to see from what's the logic, for instance.
Thank you. There's plenty
to
wait.
So let me start Let me start with the question about migration. It's difficult to provide a straightforward answer to your question. Migration is part of the world we inhabit. It takes different forms. We tend to focus on the migrant as a victim of processes of destitution, absolute destitution, which are dependent on the manual. But migration takes also other forms, and we should be able to adapt them in their entirety, also to explain the processes of absolute destitution that I was mentioning. Speaking of internationalism, migration is, of course, very important. In a single city like London, also Bologna, you are confronted with the problems that one century ago were considered to exist among different nations. Migration is often a potentiality for struggles and for the forging of what I like to call the politics of liberation. But it is not so by nature. I have been associated for many years with the autonomy of migration approach, and the autonomy of migration approach has been often criticized because it could romanticize migration. I never romanticized migration. And maybe this is because I started to work politically with migrants when I was quite young, and so I am aware of the predicament that often shapes their life. But I have also the experience that migration can be a potentiality, can be a good quality. So it depends on junctures, it depends on specific situations, it depends also on the composition of migrant movement. Moreover, anticipate a couple of words regarding the last question. Speaking of migration also implies speaking of the perception of majoritarian populations. The perception of majoritarian populations with respect to migration is kind of terrible in Turkey, like in Italy, like in India. So we have to take all these aspects into account, particularly in a moment in which we are experiencing a kind of return, aggressive return of nationalism. And nationalism is a problem for Mayans, as we know, because it is historically associated with racism. And today, attempts to create conditions of violent hierarchization of migrant populations, more than conditions for the expulsion of migrants. So I repeat, depends on the conditions, but we cannot think of internationalism without taking very seriously migration as a virtuality, as a question that is open in front of our eyes. The question of let's say recuperation of practices, languages of let's say counter-hegemonic politics by hegemonic powers. You know, I tend to think that this is part of the struggle, that in the moment in which a political practice, a political slogan is recuperated by hegemonic powers, it means that something did not work. It means that there was defeat. Although it is, of course, more complicated than that, because sometimes the recuperation of, let's say, the political language of struggles can also mean that hegemonic powers are compelled to settle accounts, to take into account the claims and the practices of counter-hegemonic conflict. But you know, hegemonic struggle is a constitutive part of social and political struggle. It should not be intimidated by the power, you know, of hegemony. We should continue to look for tools for opening cracks in the structure of those powers. And the last question, you know, for me, it is difficult to imagine to write books that speak to the legendary the job. I try to cultivate connections to majoritarian populations, and I look for the right words to talk to them. I usually do not think in terms of capitalism before speaking to people in bar in Bologna, where I used to go every morning, where I try to engage in conversation with very normal human people. Regarding Simon, more than traveling, very good friend of mine, I think there are different ways work toward the common goal. I have chosen to focus my own research on capitalism, which means that I employ a language heavily influenced by Marxism that can sound in a way outmoded or difficult to follow, but that's that's the way in which I try to understand the world in which I live, trying to multiply encounters with people that employ a different language. It's a bit too ecumenic, maybe, but I'm convinced that there are different ways to work toward a common goal. And of course, there are different conceptual languages that can be tested and employed.
Yes. One, two, three. Oh. Maybe four, we'll take four.
Okay.
I get up for the online audience.
Thank you so much, Sandro. I think I want to ask two questions about the present, right? And the first one is about how you see the relation between the internationalism against oppression and domination that you are looking at in the struggles. Is what some people are arguing is a form of white internationalist technologies, and it's actually enabled by infrastructures, by different forms, and that seems to be quite successful, right? The translation and so on. And how do you see that in the present, right, in terms of an internationalism of the right?
Of the right. Yeah.
Uh-huh, right? Yeah. And my second question is about war regimes. Right, again, that's specifically in the current conjunction, particularly in relation to what we used to be a security regime. Is there something specific, structurally different about the war regimes that you are analyzing today? Yeah. Right.
Then, thank you so much for this talk. I have a question about. The issue of language, and you mentioned that, you know, can we find a common political language today? And you just now in your answer spoke about, you know, the kind of language that you use in like a Marxist type of language, which you said might seem outmoded. And I was wondering about the question of language and the question of history at the same time. So, you know, what do we do with the tradition, like, the traditions that we come from in that sense? What do you do with the language of, you know, working class struggles, for example, today, as the nature of work changes, for example? So the industrial proletariat is no longer kind of like the center of, you know, revolutionary politics in the sense that maybe Marx talked about at the time. So how do we make sense of the changing nature of labor and changing language, and to think from an internationalist perspective today? So what do we keep from the past, and what do we actually need to reinvent? Because we need to keep some stuff from the past. There are gains from the past, right? So how do we think about history in that sense with language? And I have another question about Bolivar's idea of the universal as a terrain of struggle. And I'm wondering whether you maybe want to meditate a little bit about what does it mean to think of the universal as a terrain of struggle? And I'm wondering whether the question of untranslatability has something to play that in that conversation. What kinds of tensions do we need to work out in the conversation around universality today?
You, and then one more, then we'll have another round.
I just wondered if you could say something about the role of individual agents in the context of the conditions of domination and oppression. So I guess describing it as conditions and then thinking about a possible universal desire for liberation. How does that, or does it even bring about any kind of duty on an individual who may be constructing to different degrees the systems of domination that we're living in?
Is that clear?
You mean the kind of unity of individuals to identify as well as defining themselves with a specific language or
connection? Yeah, I suppose it seems like the rethinking of internationalism, there is this universality to it, but some people are involved in oppression more than others, and I guess that changes regionally and economically as well. Yeah, so I guess wondering, is it possible that it's a force to, or is it a force to overthrow, or is it a force that changes the person from where they are to something else?
And the last one.
Thank you, Sandra. I think my question is very similar to Claudia's on the platform. They tried it differently. If you talk about spaces of struggle, the struggles you are about, and I can see it in the lineage of internationalism that they work. But of course, if the part of the stake is the thinking and rethinking of capitalism, territoriality, and social movements in relation, the far right, new conservative revolutionaries, and so are actually playing in the same terrain quite considerably. So I was wondering what is their place in the spaces of struggle for you?
Place.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you for these great questions. I thought, of course, the first one, the international of the right. I am really aware of the relevance of this question. I was talking about Latin America toward the end of my talk. Latin America, we are facing today a completely new time. And that light is people connected to the movement. I really appreciate the way in which you emphasize the infrastructure dimension of this connection. And I think that that existence of international divide should be for us even more to engage on the terrain that at least historically has been defined as the terrain of internationalism. But at the same time, we have to be clear about the fact that the international of the right is a nationalist international. Of course, with new features, but this is something that I see very well from my provincial point of observation, which means Italy. In Italy, as you know, we have a government of the far right, which is a really nationalist government that is playing in a very tough way on the terrain of cultural hegemony. You really see what it means that since the 1980s, intellectuals of the right started to read Gramsci, started to take things from Gramsci. So it's a nationalist internationalism, but it is an internationalism. Until a couple of years ago, the party of Governor was against the European Union. Now it is hijacking the European Union, establishing an alliance with Duda's Poland and looking at the proliferation of nationalist governments from the right within the whole European Union, playing this kind of alliance with Poland against the historical axis between France and Germany. It's a very sophisticated strategy, and it is a transnational strategy that remains deeply nationalist. So I think that He said that the existence of this international delight is for us one reason more to engage in the name of international. And also add that the critique of nationalism is a crucial task. Regarding war by James, you know, it's a notion that Brett and I have worked upon in this new book. There is also a good Spanish friend, Cedillo, who published the end of last year a book on the Ukraine war. And he also used the notion of the vision of the war. We also have spreading of the Schmittian distinction between friend and enemy beyond situations of military confrontation. We are a bit more cautious and we speak of the kind of totalizing tendency of national security, both within the state and within the economy in many parts of the world. Last week, there was a vote in the European Parliament on the proposal to devolve some of the money or the funding of the so-called Next Generation EU, the project for resilience after COVID, to ammunition, to military expense. You know, this is for me a good example of a regime war. The increase of military expenses, both within national member states and at the level of the Union, and at the same time, the spread of the rhetoric that presents this increase as a matter of fact. Thank you very much also for asking this question on language history. You know, maybe I was mining while you were asking your third question. Because in a way, the need to reinvent the notion of class after the end of the centrality of the industrial working class has been, for me, the main task since I was I grew up in the horizon of entire workings that raised this question in the mid 1970s. Let me say something about the tradition from which I come and within which I continue to work. That tradition was able to grasp the end of the centrality of the industrial working class, but to put it quickly, it continued to look for the central subject. So you have the notion of societal worker, you have the notion of immaterial labor, mass intellectuality. At a certain moment, and I like to think due to my engagement with migrants, I became very critical with respect to the search for a central subject. And I started to take seriously the question of difference, also looking, particularly looking beyond Italy, beyond Europe, beyond the maps. This has theoretical signs, of course, that are related to the fact that even Marx was convinced that capitalism required a standard labor relation. what is going the aim of going the regulator. Actually, as you may know, for instance, so-called global labor history radically criticized this idea of a standard. And in a way, think of the work of Marcel van der Linden, for instance, confronted us with this deep heterogeneity opposition of middle labor. And in a way, I have always, in the last 15 years, I have tried to work following this kind of suggestion. But this suggestion must not be taken as generic, because if you say, okay, heterogeneity everywhere, you end up without any tools. So for me, this heterogeneity is a kind of background, okay, which a solid work of, I like to say, militant equity has to be improved, because there is no strategic centrality, but there can be tactical centrality. What is sure is that today, living labor, to use this nice Marxian notion, has no pre-established boundary. At the end of my talk, I quickly declared the question of exploitation, and the way in which exploitation is discussed today. I quote this David Harvey and Agnes Taylor. You know, I think they did a great work on exploitation and exploitation, but the way in which they talk about exploitation is completely traditional. It's really taken from Capital Volume 1, full stop. You know, because they say that we think of tools only in the case in which we are confronted with free labor. I think that the problem today is also to reinvent the notion of the exploitation in front of processes of socialization, diversification, hierarchy of labor. And the university, as a terrain of sanity, or to the university, of course. But the universality is the main thing. I think it is a powerful metaphor. But again, it can remain very generic. So we have to test the metaphor in a more concrete way. I think that over the last decades, there were several such tests. Just think of the notion of equality, universal notion of equality, in Black families in the US, where the starting point is, equality for Black women is something else than for white women. In the question of abortion, reproductive rights, for instance. Well, I think that in best case, that was an attempt to stage a struggle, a conflict that has renewed the notion of equality. I think this is, an example, but an example in the way in which Machiavelli used to speak about examples, which means something that cannot be reproduced, but can inspire us. I was already saying something about the question about these processes of diversification, hierarchization that they see as the specific of the composition of today, the affair of the necessary to be aware of the importance of processes of hierarchization that produce absolutely similar positions, sub-positions. And at the same time, we need to continue to look for tools to create connections, to create coalitions. What is really scaling is the crystallization of a single subject position. If I understand you correctly, behind your question, there is in a way the issue of identity, you know, bit large. And I try to have a nuanced take on the issue of people. I do not have at all additional masses position on the identity. I don't say well, identity is not relevant because there is something more important, which is class struggle. I would never say something like that. I think that identity politics, in a way, is necessary. I think about identity politics following the lead of Frantz Fanon and the Combahee liberal collective that was one of the first to use the phrase identity. It is a moment in which, you know, subjects, let's say subjects, that are completely excluded from the field of visibility, claim their own position to the language of identity. And this is a crucially important and potentially productive moment. If you are really at the bottom, as the Combahee liberal wrote in the mid 70s, you need to claim your specificity. But this is, I think, this must be a first moment. And then there must be also a moment of opening, which does not mean getting rid of the specificity that was affirmed in the first moment. And so the need to think about, I don't say the dialectic, I prefer to say the articulation between these two moments is very important. Well, thank you for the question on spaces. Been very important for me in the last years. I have moved in a way to more of the critical geography and many philosophers. And this new book that I wrote is one of the main chapters regarding space. And it's a different kind of space than I was in the talk. We write quite extensively on what we call operative space. Make kind of distinction, which is not new, between political spaces and spaces of capital. And we try to show that, from the point of view of partiality, there is a kind of disconnection today. And we have to think about this disconnection to understand the changing, shifting shape of development. You were asking about the far right, and already replied on this, but then also about place. And this is very, very important question. As yes, many of you know, in the 1990s, Manuel Castells wrote kind of very important trilogy in which he proposed to make sense of the emerging global space in terms of a space of flows opposed to a space of places. And his point was that the paper flowed with women and places where, in a way, it was a powerful kind of conceptualization that spurred many research works, but it has also been criticized, particularly by geographers and anthropologists. For instance, of Anna Singer, that you might resonate here. And these people started to argue that what really matters is not the opposition between the space of flows and the space of places, but rather the junctures that make their observation possible. And it is, we participated, we, I mean, Brett and I participated in this kind of discussion, and our work on logistics, on infrastructures, is a kind of follow up on the criticism of the junctures. So we need, I think, a different way to look at places, a different way to look at cities, first of all. And this has a lot to do with international, you know, because the risk with any discourse on internationalism today is that it is taken as absent. You know, inside the placements. And I think it's important to develop an understanding also of the global space that allows us to come to terms with the absolute concreteness of places. Cities, from this point of view, are very important, very different cities, of course, in the world, but the form of the city, the form of the metropolis, is a good point of departure. Then, you know, kind of ecological crisis, climate change, spurred a new internet in the countryside. One of the works also in Italy, in a way, put together the ecological crisis and the pandemic that led many people, you know, to move to the country. And this was, in a way, part of the process of urbanization of the country, you know, because the people that move to the countryside were urbanized, you know, that in a way, where at the same time, the countryside remains the countryside. So you have, so I think we have to carefully investigate this heterogeneity of places, and the biggest mistake that we can do is to oppose the global to places, to the local.
Are there any more questions? Because I have many, but we have time. Yes, somebody who hasn't asked the question first. Yeah. And this way, Jean-Michel, then.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask where, in crafting the universal image, where does the intersubjective moment fit in? Is that something that the universal language comes out of, or is that something that's like, you know, consistently happening? Mm-hmm. Like, or does it come at the end after some political strategy has been made, or some encounter has been framed, and then some universal answer to domination comes out of that?
You mean the intersubjective moment? Did I get it right?
Yes.
Yeah, intersubjective. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I have two questions, but they're very quick. So the first one would be, earlier you mentioned national security and the new act on the security, both at the international level, but also within the states. So I wanted to ask, like, what's your opinion on this observable increase of, state efforts into monopolizing a new form of political violence towards protesters, or how can we rethink internationalism when the struggle is especially in liberal democracies, it's seem not to until now have how do we consider liberationist struggles as repressions appears to be ever present in the digital sphere, but as well physically, like political violence. And my second question is on the translatability of concepts and theoretical frameworks. That's obviously not an answer to the question at hand, but have you considered, or do you have any opinion on a language that wouldn't be formulated through words? So I'm thinking of this because we were talking about the international feminism, and I recall, or it seemed to me that the focus on the body was an ever-present theme around the internationalism or the shared experience of the protests and of the domination, the violence. So maybe have you considered this language beyond words, or beyond explainable concepts? I'm thinking maybe the use of artistic forms of expression. Maybe is it something that you have considered? That I would like to know.
Thank you. Maybe one more. Susie, do you still want to ask you a question? Yes. No, please.
Yes. Mm-hmm. About the spiritual logic of dispersal, that underpins the political economy of displacement.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're trying to think about how we establish coagulations of the movement, shared sentiment, pushing against, but all the while the system is splitting the body into parts. The time is casualized, you have to work through jobs. You can't pay the rent, so you end up renting a bed in London for 8 hours so someone else can occupy it 8 hours after you, and someone 8 hours after you. Your citizenship status, whether you are a migrant or whether you were born in the country, is also fragmented and called into question on racial grounds. Every aspect of life has been splintered by this logic of dispersal. How do we compose the struggle in the face of that brutal reality?
And finally, in the process of constructing that struggle, my question is about the role of translators. That's another way of asking the question of leadership. Who is doing the translation? What kind of leadership, if at all, do you have in mind for this process of translation and construction of a common political language, if any? And that will take us to 8 o'clock, I think. All of them.
Yes, thank you. I would be delighted to go on and be nine. And...
But we have a reception, so we can continue.
I just need to smoke.
That makes two of us.
So let me start with the intersubjective moment, which is a very important point that is connected with the translation approach. I think that the intersubjective moment, you know, what I was calling before with kind of altusserial resonance, the encounter, is a constitutive moment. It doesn't come after the forging of a new political language. There is no forging of a new political language without the proliferation of intersubjective moments that also challenge the very structure of activities. You know, contended that the subject must be torn apart. It's really like this image. It happened to me several times. Several times in collective situations, through encounters, what kind of existentially challenging, you know, and my subjectivity in a way, you know, began to change. And I think it is another thing that happened. You know, your question bring me to say something more about this phrase, politics of liberation, that I use quite a lot, maybe too much. It can be too emphatic, can turn out being rhetorical, but for me it is very important because I really sense the need to go beyond resistance. And if power is omnipotent, is kind of overwhelming, you can only resist. And maybe this is the case, I think we have to continue to search for tools that allow us to go beyond resistance, that allow us to be kind of constitutive of new subjectivity, of new spaces, of new forms of life. And so the politics of liberation for me is also kind of provocation because I see that most people on the left in social movements think of struggles primarily in terms of resistance. Of resistance in a very simple sense, Martina could say a lot of interesting things about the way in which Foucault understood resistance, but I use it in a kind of naive way. The power is overwhelming and we have to contain it and to look for some kind of space of subsistence. Having said your questions are very, very interesting, you know. Let me say something about the very notion of national security. Today, there are several scholars, usually in international relations or in geopolitics, that work on the topic of national security to propose the notion of political capitalism. You know, political capitalism is a notion that comes from Max Weber's work on ancient Rome, and in the last couple of decades has been used, you know, only with respect to authoritarian, despotic countries, to grasp deviations from the ideal typus of market economy. But over the last couple of years, there are more interesting words in that. That, for instance, compare the US and China, and consider both the US and China as instances of political capitalism. I think these are interesting works. I think the topic of national security is very important. At the same time, I think that we can also make a different use of the notion of political capitalism, which means that we can use it in order to grasp the political effects and implications of operations of capital. If you take digital platforms, for instance, that play quite an important role in this logic of splintering that you were rightly mentioning, well, they are governmental devices. And once we try to think of capitalism going beyond the idea of a firm boundary between politics and the economics, I think things become more interesting. Regarding your second question, sure, you know, the body, the politics of the body, the politics of commotion, the political dimension of emotion are pretty important. And you rightly stressed that in Latin American feminism, this is really a figurative moment. And I also think that the arts can provide tools, you know, to create, to translate imagine. This is banal to say, but I'm very interested in this aspect. What remains difficult for me is to think of politics of the body, an artistic radical practice without words. So the way in which also the politics of the body can forge words is very important. I don't think of a primacy, let's put it so, of the political language. The political language that is not able to connect with the politics of the body, with the political dimension of emotions, is not an effective political language. So this is a really important question. Thank you for asking it. And before coming to the translator, I know this question of displacing, this logic of space. I like very much the way which you describe it, the splitting of the body into parts. It's a tendency that I have been personally investigating over the last 4 or 5 years with respect to digital platforms, with respect to the way in which digital platforms work. And even beyond what you eloquently described, what interests me is also the way in which digital platforms assemble collective subjectivity. Mm-hmm. And you can study that looking at the way in which data are used to build a different kind of subjects, fish lovers, potential terrorists, and so on. But But you can also see it from the point of view of the just think of food delivery. It has become very, very visible during the pandemic, of course. And during the pandemic, in many places, including London, the composition of platform workers changed quite dramatically. And platform workers became, at least the majority, migrant workers. Mm-hmm. In Bologna, it was apparent, you know, because in Bologna you had a mixed kind of composition of islands. You had migrants, especially from South Asia, but you also had students. With the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic, students disappeared, and you had only migrants that also were able to self-organize, to organize strikes, and so on. But what your question suggested to me is the way in which digital platforms work in food, not only for delivery, but if you think of a rider on a bike, he or she is focused on the smartphone, also on the smartphone. He or she gets orders. So it's a completely individualized study. Food delivery platforms, you immediately realize that the work of this particular rider is a source of value for the company only insofar as there is a multitude of actual and potential riders connected to the algorithm. You know, and in this case, you have a kind of split, you know, between the individual experience of Raymond, in this case, and the cooperative dimension of what you are doing, that is completely expropriated. You know, but the ground of such processes. It's difficult to think of politics of liberation. I think we should continue to struggle for the forging of a politics of liberation. And of course, speaking of the ratio of there are many cases in which most of the people involved in an encounter are translators. Mm-hmm. But there are other cases in which you need a translator. I don't think that the figure of a translator is the equivalent of the professional revolutionary.
You don't or you don't?
I don't.
Okay.
I don't, please. But I think that there are and there must be different figures of translators, you know, kind of intellectuals, temporary. So when I talk about the forging of common digital language, I'm simply reflecting on my own experiences. I go to Calcutta, where I have good friends. I speak with dispossessed peasants, and I don't immediately understand what they are telling me. I don't simply need a linguistic translator. You know, I need to engage. I need to engage in a labor of translation, although I don't think they are. So you need facilitators, you know, and possibly not the anthropological figure, you know, criticized by Ayaz Spiva. So intellectuals can do that, activists can do that, artists can do that and do that, you know, media people can do that. I think we have In a way, I'm talking about the preconditions of a new international. I'm not at all proposing a kind of political organization. I have no idea. I'm talking about the preconditions, describe the preconditions. I think that the common political language, the common political language is a big task. It's traversed by conflict, and I think that we need different figures of not better way.
I'm very glad you say that, because perhaps hope resides in all of our capacities to be and or to become translators of such a kind.
I think everybody is a translator in a specific situation, he or she engages in context.
Well, thank you very much for this encounter, Sandro. Thank you for coming to London, sharing your thoughts with us. It was a fantastic event. And thank you for the audience.
Thank you very much.
For being here.